Ixnay on the inging say.
Oh.
Oh, hi.
Look,
oh, God.
Wait, they started. Oh man.
But I can't.
It's really funny because we were actually literally doing something else.
I'm
hi, everybody.
Wood.
I'm Kyle Rizdahl.
I'm Molly Wood. Welcome to Make Me Smart, where we are joined, as always, by you, because none of us is as smart as all of us. Maybe you can figure out how to put the links
Perhaps
in.
Some of you know how to start a show on time. We are talking about design thinking today, the idea you can solve problems by framing them, I guess the way to put it is, in a creative way, and how you can use that design thinking to solve some of the problems we talk about a lot on this program, tech and culture, mm-hmm. and maybe how the economy doesn't work so well for everybody.
We'll be talking to Sarah Stein Greenberg of Stanford's Design School. The cool kids call it the D School. I would totally like to propose now that Marketplace send me on a sabbatical to the D School.
They have those. They're called night fellowships. You can do whatever you want up there. I'm just saying.
Really?
Yeah.
Not like nighttime, though, right? Because
I'm not doing that. No, K-N-I-G-H-T, night. Dude.
That was a slow burn. I did catch up eventually, but yes. Okay. I'm working. I'm going to work on my application during the show.
We're also going to hear from somebody who's actually made a career out of design and designing things and that whole ethos, really. It was kind of an interesting conversation. His name is Jonathan Adler. He started in ceramics and he became, in his words, an eponymous lifestyle brand.
That's my other goal. That's my other sabbatical goal, is become an eponymous lifestyle brand. What is that?
We're going to title this one the eponymous lifestyle brand episode. I'm just saying.
I love that. Oh, my God.
I know.
Do that. Let's definitely do that. So we're going from design thinking to design, but we are going to start off, like we do, with our fix.
All right, so Shazam, you get to go first because you didn't put the links in, so I don't know what's coming.
Okay, the thing that I am actually fixated on is almost too on the nose.
All right, go ahead.
As we have discussed, business being ascendant in this country.
Mm-hmm.
And it was the story about how the resolution to encourage breastfeeding that was expected to be easily approved by government delegates at the United Nations affiliated World Health Assembly were stunned when the United States delegation, how did they put it? Embracing the interests of infant formula manufacturers, upended the deliberations, tried to water down the resolution by taking out language calling on governments to protect, promote, and support breastfeeding. And apparently, according to anonymous sources in the New York Times, threatened Ecuador with punishing trade measures and withdrawing military aid if they introduced the measure to support breastfeeding.
Mm-hmm. Yep. No, I know.
I mean, I don't know that a lot more needs to be said about that, except that, again, let me just say, if this is the government that you want, in which business gets everything that it needs and free, easy access to baby feeding is somehow controversial enough to threaten smaller countries over, just ask yourself how much you like the companies that you deal with every day and how you feel that they treat you. That is all.
That is all. Microphone dropped in a metaphorical sense. mine's different. Somewhat related, and it goes like this. So the president is on his way, as we speak, to Belgium, and Europe, and London, for a visit with the Queen and Vladimir Putin and NATO. The thing I can't stop thinking about, actually, I've got two now that I think about it. One is what happened at the last big multilateral meeting he went to. And truly, I'm too deep in the news because this is honestly something I can't stop thinking about. What's he going to do when he gets there? How blow it up is he going to be? And I think that's a problem because, as we've talked about before on this program, the idea of the Western Alliance is foundational to not only our physical security, but also our economic security. And that's a big, big deal. And so we're going to see what happens at NATO. The other one is, on a much, much, way, 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 way more trivial note, I'm going away next week. And I'm thinking about taking Twitter off my phone.
Oh,
yeah, it'd be a first for me. That'd be a first for me.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm not sure how I feel about that, but I'm thinking I might, because I need some mental space.
I mean, as you know, I could not encourage that more.
I know.
I have so many rules around Twitter now. It's bad. It's still not on my phone. I only access
really?
It. Yeah.
Oh, that's so interesting.
The app is still not on my phone. I still look at it on the mobile version, but
well,
it's
what?
Such a...
What?
No. But it works because it's such a crappy experience.
It's more painful, yeah. Yeah.
That I end up looking at it for 5 minutes or something instead of the hour that sometimes happens. And then I have all these rules, like no Twitter after 6, like no evening Twitter. Absolutely not.
Yeah. So I'm thinking about taking it off. That's
you should do
I'm honestly I'm conflicted, but we'll see.
Also on the plus side, I think we should probably close the loop to celebrate that all the boys and the coach of the Thai soccer team.
Oh yeah, well, you know. Yeah.
We're safely rescued.
Because honestly, in my deep dark place, I was like, this just ends very badly. But it's cool news. It's awesome. Yeah. I mean, let's remember the one guy who did pass, the retired Navy SEAL who went in to leave the canisters. But on the whole, just an amazing story.
Yeah, absolutely. All right. We're going to move on to the interview portion in which we once again, to remind you, talk about design thinking and mm-hmm. how essentially like a different approach to problem solving not only makes everything from the DMV to apps work better, but, you know, maybe government too. Write to us. Tell us what you are up to, what you are smart about, what you are thinking about the show. Send an email to makemesmart@marketplace.org or tweet us @KyRizdahl and @MollyWood. Time for a little tunage. And then we'll hear from Sarah Stein Greenberg.
So we have talked a lot on this podcast about a lot of big issues, the way capitalism leaves some people behind, ethical problems and technology today. And a lot of what we do, is look at how we got here. So we're going to dig into something called design thinking today, whether or not some of what ails in some ways society, but also technology and consumer products and a lot of stuff is kind of a design flaw. And I will fess straight up, as you will hear in this interview, I didn't really know what design thinking was till not too terribly long ago.
But turns out, by the way, it's much longer ago than you would have thought. So if you guys are just finding out about this today, like his confession's not going to make you feel that much better.
Oh, nice.
But luckily for all of us, there is an entire department at Stanford devoted to design and design thinking. Our guest, Sarah Stein Greenberg, is executive director of the Design School, otherwise known as the D School, at Stanford, and they teach classes like design thinking for public policy innovators and design for extreme affordability. And it's just I have been obsessed with this concept for a while.
Molly's already bought in, so I'm the neophyte in this conversation.
I'm bought in. Well, it's really interesting because like what got me interested in it, and it wasn't that new, but there was this whole kind of investment wave that started a little bit with like Uber and Airbnb. And in the tech world, those are companies that are seen as design companies, not necessarily tech companies. Because what they did was they took a process that everybody's familiar with, such as calling a car, right? With a whole like dispatch situation and where are you and a map and whatever.
Yep.
And they designed out all of the complexity. They considered the user experience top to bottom so that it would just be utterly seamless for the drivers and the riders and, in the case of Airbnb, the renters and the homeowners and all of that.
That's an awesome setup. That's such a great framing for this interview because it really sort of clarifies what this is all about.
Yeah, totally.
Yeah, here you go. So it's Sarah Stein Greenberg from the D School at Stanford. And here you go.
All right, just tell us, for those who, you know, people don't know, what does design thinking mean? And how is it different from, you know, designing?
Oh, yeah.
Well, great place to start. So as you walk through the world every day, just about everything around you is designed, right? Like not the natural world, which we have a lot to learn from, but every time you get in your car, every time you make that artisanal coffee in your home, every time you go to the DMV, you are in a designed experience. Some of those are great. Some of those are not so great. But somebody made that. Somebody brought that experience to life for you. And design thinking is really a set of methods and strategies and approaches that can help you improve the impact and the effectiveness of the thing that you're designing. It is really fundamentally about first understanding the needs of the people that you're designing for. It's this very human-centered, empathetic way to look at the creative process. And it also relies on a set of strategies about testing and prototyping your ideas really early.
When did design thinking separate from, and I'm making an assumption here, separate from straight up industrial design, right? Here's how a can opener has to work to get the can open. This is the industrial design for that, as opposed to however design thinkers would go about it.
Yeah, so design has really been in a constant state of evolution for the last, I don't know, 100 or so years. And I would say a big demarcation happened around the 50s and 60s. And particularly as people started to design interactions that were more than just physical products. So as machines started being something that a human would interact with on a regular basis, like a computer, or as people started to look at services as something that you could design, that's when there was a need for a more, I don't want to say universal vocabulary, but a more useful vocabulary that people in lots of different functions in industry could actually participate in.
Am I a loser if I didn't know what design thinking was? Literally until 5 years ago when a marketplace colleague went and did a fellowship up at Stanford and took courses at the D school?
I would not say you're a loser. No, Kai.
So the thrust of the question is, it seems to be a bit buzzy now, right? It's gained in popularity in the last, like, decade-ish?
Yeah, that's right. And I think there are some really interesting reasons for that. I think that, you know, when I see students who have come to Stanford in part because they know that the D school is there, because they're going to be able to learn design thinking, I always drill down and try to understand why. And I think it's partly having to do with just the amount of complexity in the world today, the degree to which people are faced with problems that they know that they can't be perfectly trained for ahead of time. They're going to have to find answers to problems without obvious solutions over the course of their careers. And this is driven by technological change and all the kinds of social upheaval that we're seeing. And so the relevance of a methodology like design and design thinking, where you can even call out really clearly, okay, this is the process that I want to use for this particular kind of problem, I think that relevance is huge right now for folks in industry and government, et cetera.
So you're saying it's partly popular, not just because it's a good way to make a complicated system easier to use, but also because it's a method that people can apply in the real world.
Yeah, that's exactly right. I mean, I think that more and more people are coming up through the educational system in these fairly rigid, test-oriented environments. And then you hit the real world and you find, oh, the answer isn't in the textbook, right? The professor doesn't know the answer to the problem that I'm now trying to solve now that I work at a big tech company or that I work at, you know, in a public service role. And having strategies for being able to create really human-centered, effective, creative solutions is incredibly valuable no matter what you're going to be doing in the world.
Okay, so walk me through the intentionality, the methodology. You are presented with a problem, problem X. How do you sit and apply, or stand if you like, design thinking?
Well, I'm glad you said stand, because actually, like, not just sitting behind your desk is a really key part of it.
Oh, good.
So the real fundamental idea behind design thinking is that you try to understand the world through the eyes of the people that you're designing for. And so in practice, what we do in our classes is we actually have students get out in the world. They're interviewing people. They're shadowing them. They're, you know, sitting in their homes and their couches, really trying to understand what is it that the folks who they're designing for really need in a given situation. And then they come back to the studio and they have all of this really unruly subjective data, right? Some of it's qualitative, maybe some of it's quantitative. They might be looking at broader social trends at the same time. And they're trying to make connections through this process that we call synthesis. And that's actually the point at which we have our students come up with the problem definition. So they really chart the course from there. They say, okay, this is the problem that I found that's really worth working on. And from there, they need to then generate a whole bunch of ideas. Some of them are good, some of them are terrible. But one of the core philosophies is that you actually don't know what's a great idea and what's an okay idea until you build some kind of manifestation of them in a way that the people you're designing for can test and can experience. And then you actually reiterate your idea and you improve it by going back and testing with those folks.
Because that human experience is so central to it, and you have to sort of understand the way that a human is going to react to different things and predict that. One of the things that we have brought up on this show is whether design thinking is a thing that could help predict unintended consequences of technology. Like, is that a reasonable hypothesis? That if you were Facebook and you said, okay, we're going to introduce live video, that a process of design thinking could help you see some of the terrible unintended consequences of that before it happened?
For a long time, people created things and put them in the market without any of this kind of testing. And the kind of smartest idea won in the room, and then you just put it out in the world. And I think that what design encourages is, one, that you are really looking for what the real needs are before you put something out in the world. But then you are doing this testing in a way that can help you get ahead of some of those unintended consequences. So absolutely, if you're designing a new feature for your platform or your site or your company, you should be testing that with users early and watching the behavior and seeing whether those outcomes are in line with what your goals are, maybe your corporate goals, but also perhaps your broader social goals. I will also say that I think that this is getting more challenging in the era of technologies like machine learning, like algorithm-based design, where the opportunity to get to scale much more quickly than you used to be able to get is here. And so the implications for how do you do that kind of testing, how do you get ahead of any unintended consequences, I think it just got a lot harder. And I think this is an incredibly fruitful area. And I'm starting to see interesting collaborations between folks in the data science community and the design community coming together and collaborating to try to figure out, okay, how could we start to prototype what these kinds of unintended consequences might be when we're dealing with these new technologies?
Okay, so building off that, and I'm not sure that this is really a fair game question, but if you get out of the world of corporateness and technology and applications to consumers, is there a way that design thinking applies in the land of public policy?
Well, I will tell you that we've run a bunch of experimental classes around this, and I also see governments increasingly look to design to help figure out what are the kinds of services and experiences that they should be delivering. So in terms of public services, I can give you a really concrete example if
Sure.
you'd like. We had a group of folks who had studied at the D School and then moved to Detroit, and they've been partnering with the Michigan Department of Health and Human Services for the past couple of years. And one of the tasks that they were given was to look at the fact that actually there's almost $1 billion of unclaimed public benefits available each year. And when they looked at that system, they saw that one of the major barriers was that the form to apply for these benefits was 42 pages long. It had something like 18,000 words in it. It was like incomprehensible. It was really hard for people to get through. And it was taking a ton of time on the caseworker's part to actually correct all the mistakes. And so what they did was they really looked at the humans involved. They looked at the people who were trying to apply for benefits. They looked at the caseworkers. They looked at all the administrative rules and the state regulations governing this process. And it took 2 years and thousands of hours of these kinds of human-centered interviews and prototyping and testing. And what they came up with is a form that is that cut the amount of words and time that it takes by 80% and allows the caseworker to have a much richer engagement that's not just about correcting errors with the person who's applying for benefits. And the state of Michigan has actually rolled this out across the whole state. So we're seeing some traction in really large bureaucratic systems to rethink some of those fundamental services that governments offer using, you know, through this lens of human-centered design.
All right. So not to rain on the parade on the way out here, but what can design thinking not do, you know?
It can't tie your shoes. No, I mean, you probably could create a better process for tying your shoes.
Although, frankly, let me just say, My 14-year-old has a way of tying his shoes that will blow you away. I'm going to take a video when he gets home from this trip he's on, and I'm going to put it online, and you guys will. I promise. It's the coolest thing. And
yeah, anyway, people are inherently creative. That's right? Awesome. Yeah. So here's what I think design thinking is not great for. I always like to tell my students that if you have an idea for the solution already, one, don't use design thinking because you're going to waste your time. And two, it's probably not going to be innovative because, you know, we often start out a process with ideas that have come before. And it's only by really working with this messy, interesting data and getting to know these people that you're designing for that you get these creative opportunities, that you kind of put yourself in the way of these creative opportunities. Hmm. So you really want to be choosing a problem to work on that is open-ended, that where you're seeing some kind of disconnect in human behavior, where you can't understand why people are doing this when you think it's so obvious that they should be doing that. Those are great problems for design, where design can really help you find new solutions.
Fascinating. Well, and so empathy often comes up as a tool, and maybe the key tool in design thinking. That's also come up a lot on our show. Is this a process that can teach empathy also? You know, like if you're not already inclined toward it and you made it part of your sort of scientific curriculum, like could you start to inculcate it in some way?
So I see our students gaining empathy every time they tackle one of these projects, you know, whether that's we're running a class on, you know, redesigning, navigating the healthcare system. And we're having students work with veterans at the Palo Alto VA who are seeking mental health care services, or whether we're sending a team of students to a cardiac care hospital in southern India and asking them to look at the experience that the families of patients are having while they're waiting in the hallways. The students are really getting pushed to get out in the world, get off campus, have these very powerful learning experiences. And when they do that, they realize that the empathy that they're gaining for the people they're designing for is this incredibly powerful ingredient. It fuels this sense of urgency for, actually, I really want to create something that's going to be positive and powerful for these people. And it brings you all kinds of creative ideas that you didn't know that you could access. And you never would have if you didn't actually get out from either behind your desk or get out of the classroom and go, you know, walk in the shoes of these folks.
I'm so grateful for design thinking, honestly, now that I consider what it means and what it's all about. But I could never do it, right? I just don't have the patience to sit down. And maybe I don't have the empathy. I don't know. Little psychotherapy here, Kai, to sit down and try to figure this stuff out. Because it's really hard, right? Because you have to do so many different kinds of thinking.
It's so interesting that it is essentially like a scientific method.
Yeah.
You know, it's just a sort of a different way of coming at it. It's really, and I think to that question of what it can't do, I mean, when I started doing interviews about design thinking, you know, one thing I did was visit a company that, like a startup that really defined itself as a design company. And they said, okay, one thing that's super awesome about design thinking is that it's going to mean that people who work at these design-oriented companies and design thinking-oriented companies is going to be the greatest workplace ever. Because all we do is think about humans and every interaction and like how they onboard and what the front desk looks like and what the standing desk looks like. You know, we think about how they're going to behave in that. And I think you could argue that, for example, the tech industry has not been created the most awesome work environments for everybody. You know,
for everybody.
There are limitations.
Yeah. I wonder. Well, so here is an interesting challenge. I wonder how, and look, I'm setting myself up for a whole long thing here, how we could apply design thinking to this particular enterprise that you and I are doing.
Mm-hmm. Mm.
Right?
Interesting.
Right?
Yeah.
I mean, just as a mental exercise. And look, let's make the pitch here, right? I'll do the on-the-fly call out. Get me on Twitter, except when on vacation, at Kai Rizdahl or at Molly Wood is Molly, or make me smart at marketplace.org, and give us your thoughts on how design thinking could apply to, well, let's think about this podcast, but, you know, writ large, you know, radio and content, right? Because that's kind of an interesting thing, I think. What the hell do I know?
I guess you could, yeah. Is there an argument to be made that design thinking is journalism or should be?
I don't know. I mean, you hear all kinds of stuff about you got to meet the listeners or the audience where they are. You have to interact with them. I mean, a lot of these things that the media, and I hate that phrase, right? But the media is doing piecemeal, right? Everybody has discovered, oh my God, we have to interact with our listeners or our readers. Okay, let's do this. Get on Twitter. Or we have to be digital because they are, right? And let's do that and all of that stuff. And it hasn't been considered in any way for the most part.
Yeah.
And now somebody's for sure going to write to me and say, no, you moron. Here's 14 instances of when it happened, but whatever.
Man, you can tell Kai's ready for a vacation when he beats himself up through the entire course of the, you're doing great, Kai.
Oh my God. You're doing great. All right. So we also, as we are wont to do, asked Sarah the Make Me Smart question. It is, of course, what's something you thought you knew that you later found out you were wrong about. And here is what she had to say.
I love this question. I actually bought a book on this topic because there's a great book,
A book
by educators. There is a book. It's called, hold on.
I love it. You're stalling. She is stalling.
Yeah. No, I'm not stalling. It's called I Used to Think and Now I Think.
Based
on this. You should check it out. It's pretty cool. So I have been giving this a lot of thought. So I had an incredible class in college with this professor named Paul Dawson. It was called Public Policy in America. And I wrote a paper for it. I must have been designing like some policy or making some recommendations. And I got the paper back and I got a B-, which I was uncomfortable with, let's say. And the feedback my professor. Yes, many overachieving college students today. I had not seen that letter before, and it really rattled me. And what Professor Dawson had written was, Sarah, you have to stop designing policy as if you think that everybody else in the world is just like you. And this planted a seed for me that I think you can kind of clearly see in the work that I do today. This idea that, you know, your own biases, your own perspectives are not the things that give you great ideas about what to do in the world. It's a combination of your own intuition and skills with a deep understanding and appreciation for the different ways that people are, the different experiences that people have had in their lives, and the different needs that they might have.
My favorite thing is listening to straight-A students talk about the first time they got a B. And I'm like, sister, you don't know nothing, baby. Let me introduce you to my freshman year in college. Oh, man.
We learned so much about Sarah in that one moment, which is why, you know, she's in this completely great. Absurdly badass job.
Yep.
Fascinating. All right. Also, in our interview, we asked, how is design thinking different from industrial design, as you heard in the top, or any kind of design, really? Because even though we can talk about design in these sort of more abstract ways, policy and culture and empathy, a lot of the time when we do think about it, obviously, it's the stuff that we see and use every day, like chairs and clothes and picture frames and pillows. I'm currently obsessed with my back deck, trying to design my back deck.
Oh, see, that's my worst nightmare. I
need some of those posts that you hang lights off of.
You need lampposts for your back deck?
No, I need like 2x2s that are 7 feet tall that I can nail into the deck.
Home Depot doesn't have those.
I'm sure they do, but then I would have to go to Home Depot. I don't know. Right. I need a TaskRabbit for this.
So anyway, what we did was I talked to a guy by the name of Jonathan Adler a number of weeks ago. He is literally a designer. He has done the Parker Palm Springs. He's got retail stores. He does chairs, vases, bowls, lamps, the whole deal. But when you start him talking about himself, he starts it off a little differently. And that's what we're going to do right now. Roll some of that tape. Jonathan Adler, here you go.
I am Jonathan Adler. I am a potter, designer, retailer, and maker. I really started out as a production potter. Thrown on clay, I would rollerblade to my studio. This is in my mid-20s. Rollerblade to my studio, get there at 7 a.m., listen to NPR all day long. And at 11 p.m., when I'd heard All Things Considered for the 17th time.
Tibetan monks provided the great peace marchers with a beat, much as they've done throughout the 9.5-month-long trek.
I was like, I got to get out of here. But somehow I managed to transition from being a really small-time cottage industry guy with a very small thinker as well, into an entrepreneur. I actually came at my business from a completely non-business-like standpoint. I think that served me really well. I was very sort of airy-fairy in my thought process, and I didn't even know what an invoice was when I started. So now I know it all, but I actually think that In an era in which people in business all strive for authenticity and come up with their authenticity mission statements before they even make something, I sort of chuckle because I came at it the exact opposite way, authentically. I am authentic. I try really hard to tune out the noise of, like, my business people who, you know, I have a teams of planners and saying we need more of this color and less of that and blah, blah, blah. And I just kind of make the stuff that I really want to make. Sometimes it's extremely eccentric. It's always very, very personal. And strangely, and perhaps happily, I find that the more outré, the more eccentric, the more personal something is, the more successful it is. So I really think if your heirs won't fight over it, we won't make it. Like, I only want to make the stuff that people will hold on to, that they will fight with their siblings over, that I want people to really remember my stuff and to make an impression. So that's something I want to achieve. I want to create fistfights between siblings in the future.
Okay, so honestly, best part of that thing was producer Sharon Morris, when he starts talking about hearing ATC for the 17th time, she rolls in Tibetan monks. I love that.
I know.
You don't get much more NPR than that. Anyway, just saying. She's smiling now. She's smiling. Interesting guy, Jonathan Adler. Super interesting dude. Super interesting dude.
Yeah, I mean, I love the idea. I think given all of our consumerism, the idea of making things that last and are beautiful and, you know, maybe not fist fights exactly.
Well, you know, I don't know. My wife and I are doing our wills right now, and the kids are like, wait, do I get what? What do I get? Can I have? And I'm like, 25% to everybody, shut up. Seriously. And if you can't agree on something, sell it and split the money.
They're in on the process?
No, it's really just the 11-year-old who's like, but wait, what do I get? How about free room and board and a college education? How about that? Sorry.
Yeah, my little budding Mark Cuban does not need to have a conversation about what's going to happen after I die. Yeah. Anyway, write to us. Tell us how design affects your life, whether it is the thinking kind or the beautiful bespoke product kind, organizational strategy, you know, laws, your living room. Email us, makemesmart@marketplace.org.
Paying the bills. That's what we're doing now. Mark in Wynwood, Pennsylvania, wrote to tell us how much he appreciates the way Marketplace presents in-depth news and tells offbeat economic stories he doesn't find anyplace else. If you agree with Mark, please join him as a Marketplace investor by donating online at marketplace.org. And thanks to everybody who contributes to keep public service journalism strong.
All right, time to hear from you.
Dear Make Me Smart.
My name's Jessica from Austin.
This is Stephen Gillivray from Fountain Hills, Arizona.
This is Sandra Bond in Newport, Oregon.
We need some foreign listeners in there. That's what we need. So we got a question about how design thinking can be applied to tech. Shalene Modi from Huntsville, Alabama, left us this voice memo.
You know, there's all this discussion of, you know, moving fast and breaking things being the core MO of most tech companies. And there's also the idea that if a service is free, then the user is the product. So does that mean that the tech companies with the moving fast and breaking things philosophy are by design using humanity and civilized society to refining it for its own profit by repeatedly breaking it? So chew on that one and let me know what you think. Thanks.
Wow.
Definitely.
Whoa. I'm going to have to chew
also,
on
hi,
that
Shalene.
A little bit. Would you know him?
I know Shalene from way back in the day. He has been a regular voice on podcasts that I have been involved in since like 2005. He's totally my internet homie.
Wow. All right.
And also, yes, humanity is a living experiment for all the things that humanity is doing. I just don't think that's ever been as obvious as it is right now. Like, unquestionably, right? Mm-hmm. These companies are so big, so powerful, and so able to impact our behaviors and our brains and how our kids act and our level of addiction and our elections that you could argue that it is all a big messed up R&D process.
Wow. And you call me Mr. Doom and Gloom.
I don't know. I like to think of it as a detached view from...
All right. Fair enough.
Afar.
Fair enough.
Sarah discussed how important empathy is in design thinking, not always apparently in the move fast and break things side of the house. That, though, brought us back to our interview with Vantage Point founder and CEO Morgan Mercer. Listener Jamie Bond left us this voicemail about how a tool like VR is actually like that lightsaber metaphor that we've used before on the show.
If virtual reality immersion is truly so powerful that it can be triggering to sexual abuse survivors and healing for companies ripe with sexually harassing cultures, then how long before virtual reality technology is leveraged by marketers and political opportunists to psychologically rob us of our free will?
Well.
Oh, God.
So.
Yep.
Okay.
Crap. Okay. See, that went just from the what? It went from like the last thing to the this one, and now it's no longer a detached viewpoint because Jamie, you are so right about that.
So let's do a little trade policy, shall we? Last week, we got a question from John Casey in Durham, North Carolina, and he wanted to know this: if China puts a tariff on U.S. origin soy, why doesn't a broker in France just arbitrage the difference, buying American soy for European consumption and selling EU soy onto China? James Thatcher is a licensed customs house broker. He hosts the Tech and Trade podcast, and he left us this voice memo with his answer to this question.
Nice.
You cannot purchase goods and ship to one country and then ship to a third country because the goods would be based off the country of origin. The country of origin is basically where the good was made, mined, grown, caught, or fell from the sky. Yes, literally fell from the sky. That is a customs directive. So if you took U.S. soy and you shipped it to France and then you shipped it from France to China, you would have to declare it as U.S. soy because it wasn't grown in France. Now, if you say, oh, well, we'll just, you know, say, hey, this is French soy. If you attempt to do that, that's sometimes called transshipment. And a transshipment is basically obfuscating the country of origin. And that is viewed by many countries as an attempt of fraud. So that's bad mojo, too.
It totally is, but it also totally happens. I mean, you know, James is absolutely right, 1,000%, but it happens all the time. Transshipment is a huge deal.
So there you go. By the way, James has a podcast called Tech in Trade. That's basically what our last three episodes have been.
That's true.
We should probably have him on.
We should probably actually call him up and see if there's good stuff we can talk about.
I mean, seriously, this dude knows stuff. This is what I love about our audience, by the way. You all know stuff and are so awesome and rock our worlds all the time. And on that note, actually... Remember when I have a thank you and a shout out to Scott in Waynesville, North Carolina.
Yeah.
Remember the story about the dying possum in the lawn, on the lawn?
Oh, you crawling across the dying possum? Yes, yes.
Scott sent me a sticker, a possum sticker.
Wow.
And it just like is like the greatest. It's like a possum and it has little kitty ears on and it says, I am good kitty. And we put it on the fridge and my kid thinks it's the funniest thing he's ever seen in his life. And it's the first time I've ever felt affection about a possum.
Yeah, because they're just gross, right? You look at them and they're like giant rats. But anyway.
Exactly. So the idea that it would pretend to be a kitty.
But, you know.
It's so funny. Anyway, that was awesome. Thanks, guys. Appreciate it. Keep it coming.
All right. We're out of here. We're leaving.
And that is the show.
I'm waiting on you, yo.
I know. Just right give there. It a minute. Oh, start rocking. There we go. Subscribe.
Well, remember,
speaking of
we
the
ran
show,
out of music last week.
I know you're right. Okay, if you haven't already subscribed, there please do review us on Apple Podcasts and all over the place, and tell your friends about us because you know we always love new listeners to make us smart. And remember to try our new Alexa skill. Just say Alexa, make me smart.
And miraculously, Molly and or I, actually not and or, Molly or I will come out of your little machine there. Make Me Smart is produced by Sharon Morris. The senior producer is Eve Tro. This week's program was engineered by Ben Tolliday. Our theme music was composed by that very same Ben Tolliday and Daniel Ramirez.
The executive director of On Demand is Satara Nieves, and the senior vice president and general manager is Deborah Clark.
Oh, no, we went too fast.
You stressed me out.
God.
But now we get to dance.
That's my fault. No dancing. Beep, beep, God. Beep, beep, beep. Oh, that Ben's like, no, shut up. I'm going to turn the music up.